Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The 20th Annual San Francisco Documentary Film Festival runs through June 20th. All of the films will be on demand, and select titles will screen at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco's Mission District, which just reopened for the first time in over a year. 100% of ticket sales from DocFest's live screenings will go towards supporting the Roxy. Joining us to talk about a few highlights is Chris Meltzler, a filmmaker and director of programming for SF DocFest and SF IndieFest. Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks again for having me, Rose.
Well, great to have you, Chris, and we're so happy that the SF DocFest survived COVID. Not every film festival did. How did you all manage over the past year?
I think we just kind of made things up as we went along, as is the kind of punk rock spirit of our festivals. The pandemic started, we had a lot of our programming for last year's SF DocFest happen. And I think, like a lot of people, we had wishful thinking that things wouldn't last too long. And so we kept on kind of kicking the can down the road. But by the time late summer happened, we realized we just needed to evolve into these kind of new circumstances. And so last year's festival was all virtual. And we did that mainly because we see our kind of job is to support filmmakers around the world and kind of showcase cool new films to the Bay Area. And our filmmakers are like saying, look, we made this film for people to see it, and we'd love for people to access it however. And so those festivals went well, and we were prepared to do that for a while. And then the good news came up last month that the Roxy was going to slowly reopen. And so they've been our home base for so many years. And so we're glad to kind of, at least while the number of slots were limited, to kind of get films in front of people at the Roxy and enjoy some popcorn and good movies.
And we're so glad that the Roxy has survived. And it's great that SF DocFest is going to screen some titles at the Roxy. In fact, you already are.
Yeah, absolutely. So we just finished up our first week at the Roxy. And so we have one more week there. And so we have a lot of, great films, usually either kind of crowd pleasers or films you really need to see an audience, and also a lot of Bay Area local filmmakers as well.
What are you hearing from documentary filmmakers about how they have managed to survive under COVID?
Documentary filmmakers, by their nature, are very kind of entrepreneurial and persevere quite a lot. And so I think many were kind of heartbroken for some of the changes. They kind of were very resilient. And so, figured out, I think what I've heard from a lot of filmmakers is that it either gave them a lot of time to develop and think about the next project they wanted to make, or for filmmakers who had already done a lot of filming, it gave them a chance to spend more time in the editing room than they normally would have. And with documentaries, the editing room's really where the story's often found.
Right. So the SF DocFest runs through June 20th. So there's 10 more days. And again, no matter where you are, you can watch these films on demand, and select titles will be screened at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. Let's talk about some of the highlights, Chris. What are some of your favorite films this year?
Yeah, well, I should start with a film that's screening tonight at the Roxy, Dear Mr. Brody. It's a great film by Keith Maitland, kind of a really kind of cutting edge documentary filmmaker who some people might be aware of, an award winning film, Tower, that he did a few years ago. And Dear Mr. Brody is kind of this hybrid doc. It's a story about this hippie millionaire back in the early 70s who just decided to give all his money away, and it kind of created this craze. And it's told through different animation and recreations, and going and interviewing some of the people who were writing him letters back in the 1970s and had received gifts from him. And it's a tragic story, but also very funny, and just really just kind of puts you in the middle of the 70s and some of the kind of cultural transformation that was happening there. And so Dear Mr. Brody screening tonight at the Roxy at 7:15, and then is available online virtually at sfindy.com for the next week. And Keith Maitland, the director, is actually our Nonfiction Vanguard Award winner this year. And so each year we choose one filmmaker who's just kind of redefining documentaries and is someone to kind of look, be on the lookout for. And so Keith Maitland and Dear Mr. Brody definitely fit that bill.
All right. So you can see that in person tonight at 7:15 at the Roxy, or it is on demand. A couple films that grabbed our attention. The Revolution Generation sounds really great. It's a manifesto for today's youth on the societal forces that have helped shaped and held back their generation. Today, half of the people on Earth are under the age of 40, which is amazing to think about. And yeah, this documentary explores the sweeping changes that led the world that young people are inheriting, and then paints a picture of how this generation is confronting the U.S. political crisis and the global environmental crisis. That sounds like that's right up our alley. We should do a show about that film.
Oh, yeah. And it's really great. I mean, actually, the filmmaking team behind that, you know, was making another film about kind of the food industry at the time. And they started running across all these young people who were, you know, motivated to kind of change the world. And so this inspired this, you know, kind of in the years making film, and they actually even wrote a book. And the thing that's really neat about this film is it's like, it covers some kind of really big picture issues, but it's all told from on the ground and the young people who are kind of taking to the streets to make a difference. And so it has a more kind of personal and intimate feel than sometimes some of the kind of ideologue films that are out there in the world. So that kind of personal nature, I think, makes them, you know, a greater film to watch, but also one hopefully that'll help kind of institute change as well.
Yeah, that sounds great. It's The Revolution Generation. Another one that caught our attention is Tell Them We Were Here, which focuses on eight Bay Area artists making politically motivated, socially conscious, anti-commercial artwork. And it touches on the disappearing cultural communities through gentrification and economic instability, and celebrates an intertwined art community that has flown just below the radar, but has influenced generations. That one, I watched the trailer. That one also looks great.
Yeah, it's a really, you know, interesting film. And not just because it's a, you know, kind of a local Bay Area story, but it's kind of like a perfect film for this time where there's so many changes. And so the period in the Bay Area arts community that Tell Them We're Here documents is, you know, from, you know, the 70s until now. And it explores the kind of careers and philosophies and inspiration of eight different and very different non-commercial Bay Area artists. And it's an interesting film because it really kind of documents the kind of change that the Bay Area has gone under in those decades, but also kind of gives us some hope for, you know, what there might be in the future. And it's actually a little bit unusual is that the filmmaking team is a father and son directing team. And the father is Griff Williams, a longtime artist and gallery owner in the Bay Area, and then his son, Keelan. And so you get these kind of two different generational perspectives kind of blended together in the film. And it just really great film. It's streaming online at sfindy.com. And while that screening's already happened live at the Roxy, we had such demand for it. The Roxy's going to then play the film theatrically for a week after the festival.
Oh, great. And so that one is called Tell Them We Were Here. And a related film, Keeper of the Fire. Tell us about that one.
Yeah. So Keeper of the Fire is a really special film. As you can tell, you know, it's kind of like your children. It's like you love every film, you know, by the time you sort through hundreds of submissions, the ones that you keep or you really care about. Keeper of the Fire is about one of San Francisco's poet laureates and kind of his shared history and kind of activism and how he brings that to his work. And, you know, it's a 30-minute short film. It's paired with another local film, The Lucky Ones. And, you know, the thing that's really neat about it is that, as you might imagine with a film that's about an activist poet, is that there's kind of a very meditative and kind of poetic quality to the film. And so in the sense that it's not just an autobiography about Alejandro, but it is also about these kind of changing cultural times, particularly in Central America during that. And there's just a lot of archival footage that's kind of presented in a very creative way. And so Definitely check out Keeper of the Fire if you have a chance. And so that one, we had a sold out audience to that at the Roxy last week. And for those of you that hadn't seen it, it's now streaming online at the festival website, sfnd.com.
And let's talk about one more headliner, Summer of Soul, which is about the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival. And this has received widespread praise.
Yeah, so this is going to be like one of the hits of the summer. Summer of Soul is directed by Amir Thompson, who many of us know as Questlove, band leader, drummer of The Roots, and also on The Tonight Show. And he has kind of found this kind of hidden history of this kind of lost concert, which was kind of often referred to as the Black Woodstock. It was a music series in Harlem in 69. A filmmaker was kind of just thoughtful enough to kind of film it, and it captured some great performances, namely by Nina Simone. And all this film negative or video footage just kind of sat in somebody's basement. And for 50 years, nobody would fund the film or the editing of the film. And partly it just kind of shows you how easily it is to kind of erase Black cultural history. And Questlove kind of took it upon him as kind of a music geek and also just a creative remixer, and tells the story of this concert series that many people had never heard of. In fact, before he started the film, hadn't heard of it, and then tracked down people who attended the festival and how it kind of made an impact on these kind of African-American creative lives.
Well, that one sounds amazing. Again, Summer of Soul. And you can find information about all of these films at yourcallradio.org. The San Francisco Documentary Film Festival runs through June 20th. All of the films will be on demand, no matter where you are. And select titles will screen at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco's Mission District. 100% of ticket sales from the live screenings will go towards supporting the Roxy. Chris, thank you so much to you and your team. We know how much goes into these festivals. We're so glad that you survived. And thanks for bringing all of these great films to us.
Most definitely. And thanks again for your support of the arts community, Rose. And have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Chris Metzler is a filmmaker and director of programming for SF DocFest and SF IndieFest. Now we are going to talk about one of this year's featured films, Fruits of Labor. It's a beautiful film that follows the story of Ashley Solis, a Mexican-American teenager who started working as a farm worker in Central California, picking strawberries when she was just 15. She had to support her family while finishing high school. She also worked in a processing plant in the overnight shift from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. The film asks, what does it mean to come into one's power as a working young woman of color in the wealthiest nation on earth? Ashley Solis was born and raised on the Central Coast of California. She co-wrote the film Fruits of Labor. She spent 5 years working on food security and justice for her community with the Community Agroecology Network, a member of the River Park Video Collective. She helped make the short film Cultivating Justice. Hi, Ashley. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for really bringing us into your home in this film. It's really nice to have you on the show.
Hello, really nice to be here and to share this space to be able to say, the fruits of labor is here now. It took a long time to get it there, but it's finally here, and I'm really happy that I get to see the whole picture of it.
I bet. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We're also joined by Emily Cohen Ibanez, a Latinx filmmaker whose work pairs lyricism with social activism, advocating for labor, environmental, and health justice. Emily directed, produced, and co-wrote Fruits of Labor, which had its world premiere at South by Southwest earlier this year. And I really hope you can see this film on demand at SF DocFest. Hi, Emily. Thank you so much for making this beautiful film, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having us. This is a total pleasure, and we're thrilled to be a part of SF DocFest and to have the screening at the Roxy.
Well, the cinematography in this film is beautiful. The lyricism is beautiful. First off, Emily, can you tell us how you met Ashley and what inspired you to make a film about her and her family?
Yeah, so I was doing arts development work in Ashley's community, and that was part of the creation of the River Park Garden Video Collective. And Ashley was a part of that, and she was 15 then, and she just really stood out. Woman with, you know, a smart young woman who not only cared about bettering her life and the life of her family, but also the community at large. And I found that really impressive at that young age, with such, you know, aspirations. And so, you know, I got to know her and her family over the years. And then after Trump's election, we saw an increase in ICE raids in her community. And what that resulted in was all these young people that I was working with through that video collective suddenly were working in the fields and the factories. And what, you know, children have worked in the fields always in the United States. It's the one area of labor that doesn't protect children like any other sector. It's domestic work and agricultural work. And it's a legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and the creation of the New Deal excluded protections for workers, including children. So, but when we had increased ICE raids affecting the field, you know, targeting fields and factories where many undocumented workers are, undocumented adults began to leave. You know, there became a labor gap. And who ended up filling the labor gap? Often children born in the United States like Ashley. And forcing young people then to take enormous responsibility for their family's survival and well-being. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, this is an important story to tell. It's a story that is not being told in media. There was sort of a narrative at the time that really Trump's election was about a disenfranchised white male working class who felt angry. And I just thought, that's not the working class I know. And what I believe is true to be the working class of this country. And, you know, now that we know as essential workers, bringing the food on our tables every day. Mm. So this was important for that reason. Also, there's a dearth of coming of age stories are sort of this classic American genre. And yet it's not afforded to young women of color, especially working women. And what that does is oftentimes we see social issue films that have people of color as stand-ins for social issues. But I wanted, you know, Ashley's incredibly layered, complex woman, and I thought it was important to show her as a full person and to really let everybody into Ashley's imagination and world. And so that's why the film, you know, it has elements of magical realism and is intercut, you know, it's verite, but also intercut with some more stylized approaches. So that was really, you know, the reason I wanted to tell a story. And then I think it was Ashley's courage to say yes and to join for her own reasons as well.
Ashley, can you talk about what this experience was like for you to be filmed, to share so many intimate details of your life? I mean, we see you and your mom, you know, having an intimate conversation on your bed. And then you were also a writer of the film. So what has this whole experience been like for you?
It's been crazy for me. It's been something I've always had in my mind that I've wanted to show people what the reality of what it's really to, you know, to live under the shadow for many Mexican Americans. Mm-hmm. I believe not many people realize what it really takes to cultivate food that they eat. And they don't realize the real experience that many youth people go through. I mean, it takes many obstacles for youth to get to a certain point where many other children get that easily handed off. And I believe it's a story where it's been under the shadows and a lot of people whispered around in our community about it just because they don't have certain papers in line or they don't have the resources, the right guidance. And they often normalize this situation just because of not having the knowledge of what their rights is or what it is to really move around without being with that terror, with that fear, with that trauma that they had to cross by every time. So for me, it has been, I've told Emily and other people that it's been a really healing process for me for the co-writing part. There's certain experiences where I don't often like to go back to it, but doing the co-writing part, it was a really healing and reflection part for me. I got to go back and understand all the certain stuff. I even got to answer some of my questions I had. Many of the time I would say, I'm not doing enough, I have to do more. And I got to realize, you know what, I was 14 and doing all this. That's crazy. And I know in a way it got me to mature really fast and got me to see the world in many different perspectives. But I'm glad I was able to, you know, to get over that, because there's a lot of people that don't have that hope to get out of there and end up in those dead-end jobs for 40 years, 50 plus years. And I just hope this is a way to advocate hope and, you know, keep being resilient and don't give up at the last moment. Keep doing it and better things are going to come for our future and our community.
You know, Ashley, you make such a good point about being disconnected from the food. When the film opens with you picking strawberries, and then we also see you leaving your home late at night when it's dark to go to work in a processing plant from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. And there's frozen strawberries there that are being picked. And so many people buy frozen bags of fruits. And there's a connection to you, your friends, your family, your community. You started working in the fields when you were just 15 in the Central Coast of California. Can you talk about, you know, first off, how you got that job? What is that process like?
You know, it's a really crazy experience because often people ask me that question, and when I give them the answer, they get they get surprised because they don't understand how this is being allowed. But basically, in that company, they don't care as long as you sign the papers and you let them do the whole paperwork and you show up for that day. And then once you're out and realize you don't have a W-2. And you ask for it, and it's just like, well, you were getting paid under the table. And it's crazy to realize that not a lot of people realize that this is happening. And they realize that they have a different thinking of saying, you know, immigrants take all the benefits, this and that. But it's like they don't even have the certain papers for that. So it all depends on the company on how they do it under the table.
And we see you and others, you're basically standing and then you have to bend over to pick the strawberries. Can you talk about what this work is like and what it does to your body over time?
Oh yeah, it's really harsh. It's tiring. It's a repetitive work experience that I had. Whole 8 hours, 10 hours. By the law, you're supposed to get out by 85 degree, 90, something like that. We'd stay there if it was 110 degrees in summer. And it's all because the foreman or the people up there need to finish their quote. So if we didn't get that done, we didn't get our paycheck. But it was pretty harsh. There was times where I would come out my field area and I'd come out bending down, not wanting to get up. Because if I knew if I would get up, that would hurt my back even to stretch or to take a break. So it's a really hard experience. But a lot of people have to go ahead and do this because it's the only way out.
You talk in the film about living with three siblings and your mom. Your mom is divorced, and that's why you had to go to work to support your family. When you were 15 working in the strawberry fields, were you surrounded by other young people your age?
Yeah, that's funny because, yeah, we were our own little support system. I got to even meet a girl that was 12 years old. And at the field, you have to cover your face. You have to do everything. So it was crazy, a crazy experience meeting her and her telling me her experience as well. And it got me thinking, why don't you speak up? And it's just like, I'm too young. I can't do nothing about it. I'm scared. And it got me thinking, this isn't right. I'm normalizing this as me as well. I have to speak up and say something. So I'm glad I did that, even though I was a little bit scared at first. But like I said, a lot of people live in these shadows and nobody knows about it.
Before we go to break, Emily, can you talk about what was involved in getting this footage? Because we see Ashley and others who are working in the fields picking strawberries.
Yeah, so to get access, it was a little tricky. Some of it, you know, if it was from the roadside, we mm-hmm. could film, you know, just set up and film from the roadside. Now, to get in the fields, you know, we had to go to the company. Unfortunately, I'm not allowed to say the company, but I don't think it takes much to figure it out because I did sign some legal papers. Basically, I had to cover with gaffer's tape the name of the company, and they had someone supervising while I filmed. So, you know, watching what I did, if I talked to workers. So there was definitely restrictions placed. But, you know, we were able to get the footage and able to do that. But, you know, there were definitely limitations. Because, you know, while it is legal, for example, for children as young as 12 to work without restrictions in the fields, and there's about up to 500,000 children in the United States doing this. It's actually illegal to have children do the night shift, but nonetheless, they're doing it, as Ashley's saying, under the table. So that was even trickier because what she was doing was considered not legal.
So it's legal to have children work in the fields, but it's not legal to have children work in these overnight factories.
Yes, that's correct.
We're going to take a quick break. Emily Cohen-Ibanez is a Latinx filmmaker. She directed, produced, and co-wrote Fruits of Labor. We're also joined by Ashley Solis, a Mexican-American teen who started working as a farm worker in Central California picking strawberries when she was just 15. She also worked the overnight shift in a processing plant from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. This is all happening in the Watsonville area, to support her family while she was also trying to finish high school. And I really hope you can see this beautiful film. It is playing at the Roxy Theater this Saturday at 4:50 p.m. You can see it in person. You can also watch the film online on demand. Find a link to buy tickets at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the film Fruits of Labor, which follows the story of today's guest, Ashley Solis, a Mexican-American teenager who was working in the fields and was working at a processing plant from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. in Central California to support her family while trying to finish high school. Ashley Solis co-wrote the documentary Fruits of Labor. Emily Cohen-Ibanez directed, produced, and co-wrote Fruits of Labor. And you can see the film if you're in the Bay Area this Saturday at 4:50 p.m. at the Roxy Theater. It's part of this year's SF Doc Fest, but you can also watch it on demand. Find a link to buy tickets at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions for Ashley or Emily, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Ashley, let's spend a little bit of time talking about this processing plant where you worked from 10 p.m. until 6 a.m. You say that the factories don't have enough workers, and so they have to hire children, basically. Can you talk about how you got that job?
It was a hard experience. It was a pretty hard experience to go through that. Basically, it was just a group of friends that we decided we wanted to work. We had that maturity to say, you know what, I don't want to see my mom suffer or having to do all this for us when we're old enough to, you know, in our heads to put at least a little bit of hours in. So it was a group of friends that we decided to go and ask for a job. And well, the guy just let us know, yeah, we're looking for workers, and signed the paper here. And basically we just went in the next day at night, and it went on for them.
What was involved in that job? In that job, like Emily said, we didn't really get to see much footage of you working.
It was clock in at 10 p.m. You get there. We have a little meeting with everybody. we actually got separated from everybody. I just started noticing that. And we got separated from everybody. We would go package the fresas, the strawberries, frozen strawberries, make sure there was no, ugly ones, I guess. Just pick them out of the band. And it was just a 10-hour shift doing that the whole time.
You know, what was amazing about this, Emily, is watching Ashley, you know, talking to her mom, hugging her mom, and then leaving late at night and walking the streets from her home to this processing plant after dark. And I think what was so powerful about it is you weave in almost, you know, Ashley's, her poetic words, really. I mean, a couple things really stood out for me. My body stinks of strawberries and work when I wake up. Can you talk about just the process involved and, you know, piecing Ashley's story together, because you all just do it so beautifully.
Oh, well, thank you so much. So yeah, I can speak to, the co-writing process, if that's, I think that's what you're asking me about. And, you know, for me, you know, I love writing, and I think that it is a healing process. And working with a young person like Ashley, I wanted us to make the space, as Ashley was saying, for reflection and healing within in the process of making the film. And so we would do, we did multiple retreats where Ashley could take off of work. I could also, and we would just spend 5 days, you know, at a time looking at edited scenes. Really, you know, I would give Ashley maybe a few words to then write sort of her reactions to those, and getting into the more of the self-expression and raw kind of emotion, and then come back and help her craft those words into something that were poetic prose that could then accompany the storyline of the film. Because ultimately it is a film and we're telling a story, right? And so that was really the process, and it was a beautiful process. And I think really, I think, you know, the goal was to get inside the film would be driven from the perspective of Ashley, of a young woman navigating and making decisions, right? And this complex, you know, it's a small town, but it's actually a small town that's engulfed in the global food system. And how does one young woman and a family navigate through that, you know, how that have been caught in the system in this particular way? And so that was really the process for us. And I tell Ashley as well, it was a healing process for me. And that, you know, prior to doing this work, I had been doing a lot of war-related work, both as an anthropologist and a filmmaker, and generally working with men. And I really made a point that I wanted to focus on a woman's story, bring on a predominantly woman of color team to, you know, make this film, and to do it in a way that the process was always given kind of priority. And then we would, you know, see what the results were. And we're really proud because the results have been fantastic, kind of beyond, I think, at least what I had, you know, I these are kind of dreams. And I think that the film is reaching so many people, having a strong festival circuit. We've just launched today our social impact campaign in collaboration with the Latinx House, Poderistas, Justice for Migrant Women, and in collaboration with the Guadalajara Film Festival. So there's so many efforts. And yeah, the process, was very important to how the story would be told. And I think contributes to, really the emotional connection that I think so many people have with Ashley and with the story.
Ashley, can you talk about how hard it was to juggle all of this work? I mean, especially I'm just thinking about you working from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. and then trying to go to school and concentrate the next day. Another line that really stood out for me is you said, how I wish I had a less difficult life to only worry about the things girls worry about at my age.
Yes, it was a really hard time for me. There was a point in time where it says in the movie that I almost thought of dropping out and giving up, just because it was too much stuff that I had in my hands at that time. It was work, trying to take care of my sisters and my brother, and trying to be there for my mom as much as I can be there, and just putting my pride and my own self dreams to the side, just so I won't see them suffer as much. So yeah, there was a point where I wanted to give up, but so I suddenly, you know, that bond with my mom, she got me back into my dreams that I had before, and she was able to be my support system to keep going, even though we were going through a really harsh moment at that time. So there was a time I wanted to give up, but I'm really happy that I was able to go through and overcome all the obstacles.
In one scene, we see you meeting with, I think it's a counselor, about your credits at school and how you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Did your teachers and counselors know that you were working an overnight job?
No, and I hope this film wakes people up, wakes social workers from school, counselors, to be more on task and not just wait for the paycheck. Most of the times we would get in trouble for not getting there to school, and it's like, why do you even care if you don't? The only thing you care is about your paycheck. If you really cared about it, you'd be on one-on-one without what's going on. How can I help you? These are the resources. You could go ask the government for help. You don't have to be the only one being there and helping yourself out. Many of us don't realize that there's government help that people could apply to. And what they do is just go and work for their own selves and for their own family. So I just hope that counselors, teachers get to have a better connection with their students and let them know about the resources and be more there for guidance.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Peter in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I'm Peter. I'm all the way in Florida, but what I do from Florida is I actually contribute to 50 different charities, and it's so when I hear outrages on the news and whatever, I can say, no, not because of me, or I helped. And when I was hearing your story, I thought, yeah, I think I got that covered. I give money to Earth Justice, and I haven't heard that organization mentioned, but just from what I know about what Earth Justice does, they are looking into the problems that you're discussing. Can you enlighten me a little about the role that Earth Justice plays in these outrages?
I'm not sure why you'd bring up Earth Justice for this. They're an environmental law firm. I mean, they do great work.
But they're involved with, they said, migrant workers and environmental aspects as they relate to people working in the field.
Yeah, I'm not sure what work Earth Justice does in relation to that, to this issue. But if you're looking for organizations that do work on these issues, that was another question I was going to ask you, Ashley, as you talked about mm-hmm. some of the assistance that is available. And just to give listeners a little bit of background, your mom is amazing. We learn about your mom. She cleans houses 7 days a week. She came to the U.S. because she was very sick, and she got medical care in Texas. She was there for a month and got a temporary visa. She's lived in the United States for 22 years. And, you know, what do you think, what other assistance or organizations that could help families like yours? As you said, social workers should be more aware of this, teachers, counselors. Can you talk about maybe some organizations that are doing good work in this area?
Yeah, the one we went with was Mariposas. It's something, I'm not sure what it is, but they do legal work with undocumented people, and they help you get your papers on check, help you know your rights, also any questions you have. What else did we have? Counselors that helped us out. I had one teacher that helped me out a lot in school, so that was my number one supporter, and her name, I know her by Miss Rowe, Sarah Rowe. Other than that, Emily knows more the names of them.
Yeah,
what would you add?
Yeah, so Mariposa Legal Services were amazing and provided pro bono. You see Tanya Rodino featured in the film, giving some awareness that a lot of parents think that because of the risk of family separation, if you're undocumented, that the oldest child, it's a strategy in the community, adopts the younger siblings. But what we learned with Mariposa Legal Services is they have a program called the Child Protection, why am I forgetting the program's name? But basically, it's that you can do legal guardianship with multiple adults. So Ashley became a legal guardian, but even if you have another adult in the family who's undocumented, so in the case of a deportation, that your children aren't taken by Child Protective Services and put into foster care. The other organizations, which how I met Ashley was through the Community Agroecology Network, a wonderful organization. My sister happens to be the executive director of it, are working on food security in Ashley's town as well in Nicaragua and in Mexico. And they have decades of work and research that they do around fair trade and creating more equitable models for food production. And then I want to highlight the great work of Justice for Migrant Women, you know, really at the forefront of legislative change. For example, one of the there's few pieces of legislation that the film will be used as a tool, an advocacy tool, one being the CARE Act. It has been introduced to Congress for 10 years now. Let's see if this year they can do that, to raise the age of agricultural workers from 12 years of age to 16. An impossibility for some reason for Congress to pass in this country. But there needs to be better regulation and protection for children in the United States who, you know, are in towns where agricultural labor is the predominant kind of economic engine. There's also the Immigration Modernization Act, which has passed through the House. We want it to pass through the Senate. And also another Farm Worker Act to protect farm workers. Mm-hmm. So there's various organizations that are, you know, that are pushing legislation. Please call your Congress people. If you do that, and to support these acts so that we can get, you know, legislation passed that protect children and families, working families and immigrant families. But I would really encourage you look at, you know, Justice for Migrant Women, another wonderful organization that's women-led, Poderistas, Poderista, doing wonderful work. In terms of narrative shift and culture change, the Latinx House. You know, I can send you guys a list of organizations if there's any sort of web presence. But there are many organizations who are doing the work. And, you know, I think it's really important to also look at who is leading these organizations, you know, and what's really inspiring of the ones that I mentioned. They're all led by women of color. And I think that's really important that women of color are at the forefront of change.
Well, thank you for calling in, Peter. Since you're in Florida, you probably know about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. That's also a really important one. Going back to what you said, Emily, about children, at the agricultural labor is the only sector of labor in the U.S. where children as young as 12 can legally work unlimited hours. The other thing we were thinking about watching the film, Ashley, is did you feel safe going into the fields and working overnight? A Human Rights Watch report in 2019 called Children Working in Terrifying Conditions in U.S. Agriculture found that more U.S. child workers die in agriculture than any other industry. Every day, 33 children are injured while working on U.S. farms. And again, 15 years old, you are technically considered a child. And the other thing I was thinking about is we've done shows about the sexual harassment and sexual abuse of farm workers. So did you feel safe when you worked in the farms and went and worked in this overnight processing plant?
Well, these things are still happening, and I feel like it takes advocates or people to come ahead and, you know, show the light what it really is. I got to experience many people fainting because of the sun temperature and them just getting put aside and then wait for a while and then you come back into the fields, the crops. So they weren't even sent home even if they wanted to. So it was a really crazy experience. You saw people fainting and working under the hours of heat, 10 hours. Sometimes you don't even get the, the overpay of the hours. You saw a lot of children there just being their own support system at times. And it's just, it's a crazy experience to be working there with many harsh regulations that are not even regulated. I feel like it is. And yeah, there's a lot of sexual harassment, I could say that. And just the conditions are very poor quality.
We should say, Ashley, you know, what message do you think this sends, given that we're talking about California here, a wealthy, wealthy state that is run by Democrats, and yet this is happening in the fields? I mean, there's been some improvements, but there's so much more work to be done.
Yeah, I just hope people take out of this, you know, that there's always hope and there's a way to get out of it and, you know, not to stay stuck in that position. I know most of us end up giving up and just deciding that this is going to be our life because this is the only thing we know how to do and this is the only thing we have offered. But no, we have a lot of other stuff offered. We just have to find the right guidance, the right resources, and the right people we could trust with. Because most of the time, these people give up because of the trust bond that other people break, or just the way they are discriminated. You know, people are resilient enough, but it comes to a point where they just give up because the discrimination, the you know, that slap in the face they give you, that backstabbing at times. So I just hope this is a form of hope to continue on and that it's not the end. We still have to continue being resilient and not to give up halfway of what we've already done.
Let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Kathleen in San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you. I imagine that a lot of people are like me that think that they're liberals and that they know something about what's going on, that have no idea that there is no protection for these children, and that as your guest works two jobs, her mother works 7 days a week, she has to take care of her siblings as well. Her second job is 10 hours at night a day. And I just am shocked that this is allowed, that this can happen. And I know they're trying to get congressional action, but the other thing that I wanted to add is, but is it necessary for them to survive, their family, to have this income from the children working? It sounds like they're kind of caught in a really difficult situation they have no control over.
Yeah. Ashley, do you want to comment on that? And then Emily?
Yeah, I think it comes to a point where it's like you come at an age where you see other kids wearing certain stuff where that you're outdated. And there's certain stuff that you want as a young person. And the stuff your parents give you, it's just enough to survive, you know. So it's always a survival journey you're on. But I've always put in mind, you know, if I want my stuff, I'm going to go ahead and get it for myself. I'm not going to put my mom through that. And I do realize that that's how a lot of us youth get through life. It's like we get our own stuff for our own family. And I feel like it comes to a point where youth get to a level where they're really mature enough and get to decide when they want to go ahead and work and even go behind their parents' backs. Because I do admit I went behind my mom's back. When she found out, she was pretty upset because I ended up giving up in school. So that's when I got my stuff together and I was like, you know what, I could do this. I could get out. I'm not going to let oppression get to me, and I'm going to go ahead and get this stuff done and just let other people know that even though we're climbing a mountain, it's possible. A lot of people get stuff easily handed, but, you know, it takes obstacles, hurdles to get through them, and it just makes us way stronger.
Ashley, we're almost out of time, but what are you doing today?
Today I'm continuing school, and hopefully I get my it's a really long process I've been going through, but hopefully I get my agriculture and accounting degree, my master's, so I could start a whole new structure with farms, and I could provide a better beneficial to farm workers and just let them have a piece of what is theirs. Not a lot of people realize that sometimes the earth, the soil is the only thing that that they have, and that's the only thing that they've known how to cultivate from their roots. So I just hope I'm able to fulfill that need for people like me.
Oh, that's incredible to hear. We'd love to have you back to talk about the work that you're doing. Emily, we're almost out of time, but Kathleen, I think, brings up a good point. A lot of people just don't know.
Yeah. So, you know, I think what's important is that we, like Ashley was saying, there's nothing inherently, should be inherently denigrating about, you know, providing food. There's an incredible amount of knowledge, and the relationship to the land is a deep one. And why in this country is it then treated as denigrated? So it is true. Yeah. You know, making it so children don't work, families need the money. But what if we thought about a different system and where we actually valued the work, where we paid, where there was a requirement to have better pay in the fields, where families didn't have to live in terror? That's why we need the Immigration Modernization Act. So there is a pathway to citizenship. And so that families do not have to live in this terror every day. So there's many, you know, acts and legislation. There's also cultural change that needs to happen in the way that we understand food, not talking about essential workers as heroes, but as doing work that is necessary and that is valued and that is paid adequately so you can live a dignified life, and that children can make choices and seek education and be able to seek their dreams. And I think it's so important what Ashley's doing right now. She's at Cabrillo College. She's continuing her education, and she has aspirations to create a farm where it'll be this different model. So it is, you know, we're talking about the legacy of the Americas, the legacy of slavery. It is a huge mountain to climb. But there are people on the ground that have been fighting for decades, for hundreds of years, and the fight continues with young people, inspiring people like Ashley.
Well, thank you for making this incredible film, Emily. And Ashley, thank you to you, your mom, and your family for telling your story. The film, again, is Fruits of Labor. If you want to see it in person at the Roxy, it's this Saturday, 4:50 p.m. You can also watch the film on demand. Find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. Emily Cohn Ibanez and Ashley Solis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.